Hey, it's Carolyn.
And Marco.
And we know you are getting tons of these requests right now for Giving Tuesday. They have flooded my inbox today.
But if you've ever considered giving to the world, ever said to yourself, sure, I listen to the show, I probably should help support it.
Now is the year to do it. Federal funding cuts mean the future for public media is more precarious than ever. So your support is needed now more than ever.
All I'll say is this. On this show, we listen to people all around the globe every day. Imagine what would happen if that kind of bearing witness just stopped. Yeah, a nation that cannot hear the world cannot hope to lead it.
So profound, Marco. All right, thank you for listening.
And here's the show.
President Trump has ordered the U.S. military to use lethal force against suspected narco-terrorists. He has also pardoned a former president convicted of trafficking drugs from Honduras.
He and his brother are accused of moving hundreds and hundreds of tons of cocaine to the United States.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, Juan Orlando Hernandez, convicted and now free. Also, how Shenzhen, China went from backwater to metropolis in less than a generation.
Just here where we're sitting, literally almost every building around us didn't exist when I came here first.
And from our science desk, why immature ants tell their colonies when they're ill.
They signal that they should be destroyed.
The ultimate self-sacrifice of ants, today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here today. Last year, the former president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, was sentenced to 45 years in prison in a U.S. federal court in New York. He was convicted of transporting cocaine into the United States, hundreds of tons of cocaine.
Lots of people saw that conviction as a hopeful turn in the long fight against illegal drug trafficking. But on Monday, Hernandez walked out of prison a free man. He was pardoned by President Donald Trump. To learn more about Juan Orlando Hernandez and the pardon, we reached out to Stephen Dudley. He's the co-founder of the media outlet Insight Crime. Dudley told me the former Honduran president's relationship with the U.S. is complex.
On the one side, he was lauded by the U.S. government for his reimplementation of extradition. He worked hard to purge the police in Honduras. And on the other side, he and his brother are accused of moving hundreds and hundreds of tons of cocaine to the United States. So he has this kind of strange duplicity throughout his career. And it has led him now to be, again, on the other side of the fence, in this case, favorable to him, so he can get out of prison.
So in the decade before he was prosecuted, Honduras had received millions of dollars from the U.S. government to crack down on drug trafficking. So how did its former president come to stand trial in New York last year?
He spent his time in office really currying favor with the United States for doing these things that I mentioned, re-implementing extradition, working very hard to purge the police. He extradited and really was instrumental in dismantling a number of the criminal groups that were operational at the time, the biggest criminal groups in Honduras. Those same groups, the leaders of those same groups, became the key witnesses against him. And his brother, of course. And this was crucial, that the fact that his brother was prosecuted ahead of him really laid the foundation for the trial against him. And it wasn't just a trial against him. It was a trial against his entire government. The United States documents in the case against his brother are astounding. They lay out an indictment of an entire government that became essentially a criminal enterprise. And that is the government that Juan Orlando presided over. Mm. And that's what's so jaw-dropping about this particular pardon.
Well, tell us about some of the evidence that these witnesses brought to court that led to Hernandez's conviction.
One was a former mayor named Alexander Ardón. And he had been working with Juan Orlando really since the early 2000s and his brother. And they had been basically engineering their own election results in the sense that they were buying all kinds of favors. And there was a lot of money exchanged between them. This was drug money that was exchanged between them to prop up their party, the national party. That party became the big party in the country, one Congress, and that's where Juan Orlando became president of Congress. And then that set the stage for him to win the presidency. So in essence, it was drug money that came from these enterprises that led to their ascension to power. Then they held power and did that sort of dance with the United States. And then he found himself in the crosshairs. And an incredible twist here is that the man who was behind the prosecution of Juan Orlando's brother and really laid the foundation for the prosecution of Juan Orlando is Emil Bove, the same Emil Bove that was named to the Justice Department by Trump himself and is currently a federal judge appointed by Trump. And I wonder if Donald Trump has talked to him about Juan Orlando Hernandez.
There was also this stunning statement from a U.S. prosecutor at the start of the Hernandez trial in February of 2024. The prosecutor said Hernandez had boasted at a meeting with drug dealers that, quote, together they were going to shove the drugs right up the noses of the gringos, end quote. Now, President Trump was asked about the pardon, and he says Hernandez was treated unfairly. What does he mean?
I think it's just a signal that this is a government that, or at least a political party, that the administration of Trump, and Trump in particular, sees as favorable to them. I don't know as though we can read this any differently. The man was convicted of what Trump and his administration has said is the most heinous of crimes, is drug trafficking, which they have now declared a war on. So it just doesn't square with what they say they are actually trying to do and what they are actually doing when they pardon somebody like Juan Orlando.
So, Stephen, today, what are you hearing from people in Honduras who are reacting to the pardon and the release of Hernandez?
So, on the one hand, of course, there's outrage. And on the other hand, there is a sort of sense of sort of resignation. This comes, of course, amidst a very tightly contested election over the weekend, in which President Trump obviously put his thumb on the scales in favor of that same national party that had propped up, in essence, a narco government. So this is where we stand, next to a political party that essentially had created a government or a regime that was, in essence, in bed with drug trafficking.
As someone who follows all of this kind of activity, what do you make of the timing of this release?
It was just as the Hondurans were going to the polls was when President Trump announced that he would be pardoning Juan Orlando. So it was a nod to the National Party and that election. And just sort of stricken with irony in the sense that while they are seemingly surrounding the Venezuelan president for what is notably also a very criminal regime, they are releasing what was the poster boy for the Honduran criminal regime.
Finally, Stephen, what message does Hernandez's release send to drug traffickers worldwide about accountability?
I think what we're seeing over and over with the Trump administration, not just with Juan Orlando Hernandez, is certainly that personal connections are what really matters. Go through people who know him, who have influence on him, or if you can influence him directly. And certainly if you can offer him something on the other side. So there seems to be a transactional nature to all this. So if I'm a drug trafficker of any stripe, then I'm looking for those two things: access via people who are close to him and illustrating that I have something to trade on the other side of it. That's where we are.
Stephen Dudley is the co-founder of the news outlet Inside Crime.
If you caught a cold at Thanksgiving, the courteous thing to do afterward is wear a mask, wash your hands a lot, maybe call out of work so you don't get anyone else sick. But in colonies of ants, social etiquette around sickness is very different. Erica Dawson just discovered something new about this. She is the lead author of a study published today in the journal Nature Communications. It found that immature ants tell the other ants in their colony to kill them when they develop an infection. I started by asking Dawson how and why they do this.
The young ants, which are called pupae, are not able to move, so they're stuck in place. And normally when sick ants, adults, are infected, they leave the nest. But obviously the young ants can't do that. And so the pupae have come up with a communication system in which they signal by changing their chemicals that are found on their cuticle to let the workers know that they are indeed sick and that they should be destroyed.
So this is a chemical signal that these pupae send out to say, you know, I'm infected with this fungus. It's time to kill me. It's like it's self-sacrifice for the betterment of the whole colony.
Exactly.
So this was one species of ant that you studied and one fungal infection. Is it clear if this happens with other types of infection, or do we know if it happens with other species?
So we know that there are other ant species, closely related ant species, that do this destructive disinfection. But we don't know if there's a signal at play. So we don't know if the pupae are actually signaling for this destructive disinfection. But one could presume or hypothesize that that is indeed the case. And we know that other Hymenoptera, so for example, honeybees, remove infected brood, so infected young, just like we see in the ants. But we don't know whether they are signaling either. So I think it's an interesting avenue to investigate in the future.
So it's been known that some other species kill sick pupae, but it's not yet known. You're the first to prove that there is a signaling happening here.
Yeah, this is the first study to show that this is really an active signal on the behalf of the pupae that leads to their sacrifice.
So what happens to the bodies of the pupae once they are killed? Can they still infect the rest of the colony, even if, you know, they have been killed?
So the pupae are covered in a cocoon, which is like a little paper encasing. The workers remove this cocoon and then they bite holes into the pupae and insert formic acid. And this formic acid acts as a disinfectant, so it will kill the fungus. Then the bodies of the pupae can no longer become infectious towards the other members. And they'll remove these bodies as well from the nest.
Very efficient. I'm curious how exactly you study this kind of thing. What did your experiment look like?
Well, it's quite hard to show that something is actually a signal and not just, a passive cue that the ants are picking up on. So you might imagine that maybe the fungus can change something and then the ants can pick up on these chemical changes.
Right. Do they like smell the fungus itself instead of a signal?
Yeah. So we came up with this hypothesis that if the pupae were indeed signaling to the workers, they might only do so when the workers are present. So that was the basis of our experiment. So we basically had four groups. So we had an infected pupa with and without workers, and the same setup but with uninfected pupae. And what we found was that it was only the infected pupae with workers that showed these chemical changes, which would suggest that, in fact, that they are actively controlling when they change these chemicals on their body.
I'm curious, does this tell you anything larger or more broadly about how ant colonies function?
It basically shows that when you have a biological organization such as this, you get these altruistic behaviors that evolve. And that really mirrors what we see in multicellular organisms. So if you think about our bodies, you know, we're made up of millions and millions of cells. And some of those cells are involved in sexual reproduction, the germ cells, and others are the somatic cells are involved in doing everything else. And so, you know, this mirrors what we see in ant colonies. You know, we have the reproductive queens and then all the workers that do the jobs to keep the colony alive. And what's fascinating, I think anyway, is that we see similar behaviors evolving in these two very different systems. In our bodies, we know when our cells are dying, they release a signal which attracts immune cells, which come and then destroy these cells. And, you know, that's exactly what we found with the ants.
Interesting. So you can think of an ant colony more like a human body than a human. Not that it's like either, but It's a system and not made up of a bunch of individuals.
Yeah, of sorts.
That's Erica Dawson. She's the lead author of a study published today in Nature Communications about the behaviors of sick ants.
Just ahead, the Chinese city of Shenzhen grew fast on the government's dime. You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The population of Shenzhen in southern China has grown from a couple hundred thousand people in 1980 to about 20 million today. But unlike other rapidly growing global hubs, think Mumbai in India or Lagos, Nigeria, Shenzhen has largely avoided common problems that follow fast development, like air pollution, overcrowding, or inadequate infrastructure. Just how that was accomplished is part of our week-long series about transformation in China. Reporting from Shenzhen, here's The World's Jeremy Siegel.
It is a hot day in Shenzhen, nearly 100 degrees, even though it's almost winter. During summers here, the heat can be unbearable. But that's not much of a problem for Wen Xin, a 20-something who was born and raised in Shenzhen. Her parents were migrants who came to the city seeking economic opportunity. I find her sitting behind a computer inside a small milk tea shop. Wen Xin, who tells me I can call her Wendy, isn't tied to an office, so she often comes to places like this to get her work done. It's convenient, cool, and easy. The milk tea shop we're sitting in is located inside a massive mall, one of 800-some malls spread throughout Shenzhen, most of them connected to metro stations by underground tunnel. The metro itself is pristine, easy to navigate, and massive. Train cars are even organized by how cool they are, from moderate temperature to ice-cold AC. It only opened in 2004, but it's already the fifth longest metro system in the world, and getting bigger by the day. Shenzhen is constantly expanding, and its infrastructure along with it. That's part of what drew Daniel Camilu to the city.
Just here where we're sitting, literally almost every building around us didn't exist when I came here first.
Camilu is a Portuguese expat who moved to Shenzhen after the 2008 financial crisis.
So it's really hard to get a job back in Portugal. And I've been here ever since, and I've been working in tech basically the whole time I've been here, in marketing mostly. Started in a software company, then e-commerce, a smartphone, and then in a gaming publisher.
His story is in many ways emblematic of the Shenzhen experience. The city is built on tech, economic opportunity, and manufacturing. Shenzhen was China's first special economic zone and experienced a huge boom in foreign investment in the 80s and 90s before becoming a hub for homegrown tech companies in the 2000s. All of this led to unprecedented population growth, unlike anything in modern times. But the city has somehow managed to keep up, not just with basics like clean air and water, electricity and housing, but with striking, hyper-modern architecture that feels straight out of science fiction.
I think that the city is incredibly young.
That's Ole Scherin, a German-born architect and urbanist who's responsible for many of the buildings that have come to define Shenzhen's futuristic skyline.
It's both young in terms of its own age, merely 3-4 decades, but it's also incredibly young in terms of its population.
That youthfulness that Sharon's describing is hard to miss. In addition to the young workforce that drives the city's economy, there are babies and young children everywhere. A combination of urban convenience and ample green space, more than any other major city in China, makes it an easy place to raise children. Virtually all transportation is electric, drastically reducing the smog that you might find in other parts of the country. Sharon says he and other architects shaping the city have worked hard to achieve a balance between city convenience and natural beauty, and they received generous support from city officials in the process.
The planning department of Shenzhen has been an incredibly dynamic and open entity, and they really on a very personal level, engaged with architects coming to work there. They encouraged the clients to not choose always the safest and most boring designs, but really to have the courage to confront the future and ask questions how things could be done differently.
Now, while it's tempting to look at Shenzhen's development and say, hey, why can't other growing cities do the same thing? It's important to note that Shenzhen is in a unique situation compared to other major population hubs. First off, most of it didn't exist before 1980. So the city's planning department, the designers of the Shenzhen Metro, and architects like Sharon, they got to start with a blank canvas. On top of that, there's China's authoritarian political and economic system.
I think the key for Shenzhen is that this really benefits from the central government.
That's Jinfen Zhang, a Shenzhen-based finance professor. He says the central government invested heavily in the city's infrastructure, building fast and building big in a way that would take years, maybe decades longer in other countries.
That's, I think, one of the benefits of China's system. The central government, they support, they provide a lot of help. And also, China has this capacity to build up the infrastructure very quickly, very efficiently.
But those benefits come with drawbacks. Surveillance is everywhere. It's hard to go more than just a couple steps on the street before confronting some sort of camera tracking your every move. You have to go through security at every subway entrance. And when you swipe in at the metro gate, a camera equipped with facial recognition technology scans your face. On top of that, Shenzhen is widely panned across the country for just being kind of boring. Wendy from the milk tea shop told me that all she really does for fun is go to the gym. And here's how Daniel, the Portuguese expat, describes his day-to-day.
My lifestyle here is pretty, I don't want to say monotonous, but pretty homey. Like, I stay at home a lot of time. There's a lot of things I just don't... I don't even recognize how impressive or extraordinary they are in the city as opposed to someone who comes here for the first time.
In China, Shenzhen is synonymous with what's known as the 996 system, where workers clock in at 9 a.m. and clock out at 9 p.m. 6 days a week. So even with the ease of getting around and all the natural beauty in the city, everyday people tend not to have time to enjoy it.
Shenzhen, by virtue of being one of China's newest big cities, does not have a very extensive culture of the sort that Shanghai or Beijing or Hangzhou or Chengdu residents might feel very proud of.
That's Dan Wang, a technology analyst and author of the book Breakneck, China's Quest to Engineer the Future, which explores the positives and negatives of China's immense growth over the past few decades.
But it is a place of fantastic entrepreneurial hustle, where people get together over coffee or dinner, work out a business plan, and start executing the very next day.
That hustle, Wang says, is what's allowed Shenzhen to leave other parts of the world in the dust. And while the city is shipping out countless drones, phones, and electric cars, hustle is one thing you can't export. For the world, I'm Jeremy Siegel, Shenzhen, China.
Tomorrow in Jeremy's series, Shenzhen status as the capital of a new super region.
And just ahead, a reality check on the war in the Congo. This is The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The eastern region of the Democratic Republic of Congo is one of the most lush, mineral-rich places on Earth. It is also one of the most violently contested. Armed conflict has been raging in eastern Congo for more than three decades, going back to the end of the 1994 genocide in neighboring Rwanda. This past summer, emissaries from Congo and Rwanda were in Washington, smiling and shaking hands as U.S. President Donald Trump announced that he had stopped the war. John Lee Anderson has looked into that claim during two recent visits to the region for The New Yorker. He spoke with key players on the ground, and he came to a different conclusion about the war.
It's far from over.
When we spoke last week, John Lee Anderson shared his impressions and started by explaining the dynamics of the conflict in eastern Congo.
You have over 120 militias in this region, almost all of them ethnic-based, some of them fighting for survival or attached to a resource that they can extract from a region. It ranges from gold to coltan to charcoal. You're talking about an extremely poor human landscape, but one that's immensely rich in what lies underground. And you have the remnants of the genocidal army of Rwanda that slaughtered nearly a million people there 30 years ago. And you have many other militias that have taken up arms ever since. And you have the governments of Rwanda, also Uganda, as well as the government in Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, all supporting various factions. And earlier this year, the faction backed by and armed by the government of Rwanda had a major battlefield victory, taking over several towns and a huge swath of territory near the border in the east, complicating matters for the government. And so finally pitting its faction in the war, which it's done before, against the government of Rwanda, which in turn has armed hundreds of these separate militia groups.
It's complicated. And before we get more into the players here and who you spoke to, I did want to just take one step back and ask about the backdrop that this is all playing out against. So you mentioned that there's this, you know, intense conflict, but it is this lush, rich area. Can you just describe the landscape and ecosystem?
It's exquisitely beautiful. Along the border between Rwanda and the Congo, you have this line of volcanoes that are like something out of a storybook. They're volcanoes with a conical shape, and some of them are still live, and they're full of rainforest. The last of the mountain gorillas live in this area. And on the Rwandan side of these mountains are some of the most expensive eco-resorts. If you want to see gorillas in Africa, if you don't have a lot of money, you go to Uganda. If you have a lot of money, you go to Rwanda. It's that. Mm. And literally on the other side of the mountains, on the Congolese side, you have these militias who occasionally have made incursions and killed people. In the vast plain of jungle that stretches from those volcanoes to Goma, the city on Lake Kivu where I was, just 30 years ago, it was jungle. It's now pretty much a plain, having been destroyed for charcoal. The lakes themselves, this is part of the Great Lakes region that feed the Nile and where the Victorian expeditions into Africa took place. The competition between Stanley and Livingstone, some of the last great slaving expeditions took place here. This was an area that was rich in elephants and also where a lot of the ivory plunder came from. Mm. Deeper into the forest was where the rubber boom took place under King Leopold at the turn of the last century. It's incredibly fertile. Around Goma, there's a lot of lava scree because the nearest volcano periodically erupts and sends its lava right down to the lakeshore. It's an incredibly spectacular and beautiful landscape, and one in which the average people live in little rounded sort of huts. Originally, these would have been made out of wattle and daub, you know, mud and straw and sticks. And nowadays, very often, will be covered by a plastic sheet from one of the relief agencies in the world, you know.
Signs of this decades-long conflict there.
Yeah.
With that backdrop, I did want to get into the warring factions here. Let's start with the rebel group M23. What do we need to know, just briefly, about the M23?
The M23 is a rebel army that took up arms. It's primarily Tutsi, that is to say, the ethnic group in neighboring Rwanda that was slaughtered during the genocide. It has traditionally been supported by the government of Rwanda, which argues that it needs to protect the brother Tutsis living in eastern Congo, as well as its own people, from the remnants of the Hutu government that slaughtered them in the genocide.
Right. So you can see some of this conflict in Congo being sort of a direct result of the conflict and then the fleeing of the Hutus from Rwanda.
That's right. When the Tutsi army, rebel army during the genocide managed to take power in 1994 and seize the capital and extend its power throughout the country, the former government, the Hutu government, which was, you know, spewing the hate speech and carrying out the genocide, fled immediately into eastern Congo. Over a million people fled there, and they created camps around the city of Goma on Lake Kivu. And from there, many of them retained much of their military apparatus and continued to do cross-border raids. The Congo has never been the same since. And so the M23 is a kind of alphabet soup in the chronology of previous groups. But effectively, what happened was that it's been a cat's paw for the government of Rwanda to defend its interest and, its critics say, to control areas that are mineral rich. For the Rwandans, who are the overseers of the M23, they claim an existential threat from the Hutus, who continue to live in the jungles of eastern Congo and are supported somehow or other covertly by the government in Kinshasa.
Right. There is this evidence that M23 is actually commanded by Rwanda's authoritarian leader, Paul Kagame. You met with him. You spoke with him. How does he explain the conflict in eastern Congo? And to what extent does he take responsibility for what the M23 is doing?
It's interesting. He doesn't explicitly acknowledge that he controls the M23, but in an elliptical way, which is very much how he speaks. He speaks somewhat like a philosopher. He talks about the existential threat to Rwanda. And as long as there's a toxic or hateful ideology that threatens his people, Rwanda must act. He specifically said to me, if a hurricane is coming, you must go and fight it. You can't just wait for it to come.
Journalist John Lee Anderson reported recently from the Congo. We just heard about his conversation with Paul Kagame of Rwanda. Now, on the other side of this conflict are the forces aligned with the Congolese government. What are they fighting for?
Increasingly, under the current president, Felix Tshisekedi, they increasingly have used sectarian language, describing the foreign invaders, the Tutsi invaders, and thus putting their finger under the scab of these very inflamed ethnic tensions that have roiled the region for years. I spoke with some fighters that fight on behalf of the government, and they referred to their enemy as Tutsi, very much an ethnic enemy, and they were Hutu. And so it comes down to this deep-seated tribal division that's been exploited by politicians. So one has to remember that over the past 30 years, Rwanda and its forces, allied forces, have invaded the Congo twice. Mm-hmm. And despite the fact that they're a tiny nation, they're renowned for their fighting prowess, not just there, but across Africa. They punch way above their weight. And in the case of the Congo, those Congolese I spoke to tend to refer to themselves in a kind of an aggrieved way as a country that's always been exploited, you know. The Belgians exploited us. Then it was everyone. And thanks to the Rwandans, we haven't been able to get on our feet.
Mm. You visited an outpost for MSF, Doctors Without Borders, where more than 300 beds filled with people who were wounded or sick were located. These were mostly civilians, as civilians always do get caught up in the middle of war. The acting director of that facility said, though, that they do treat fighters on all sides of this conflict. And I wanted you to talk about how that works logistically.
That was an extraordinary experience because there's a number that the combatants who, by the way, control hills immediately outside of this raggedy little town surrounded by jungle. So they would ring. Everybody has mobile phones now, even in the poorest of places, right? And so assuming they're in a place where they can get a signal, they call a number. And at the hospital, there's a unit which lets the M23, which is now in control of this town, know that it has what they call a movement. The movement means that they are going to go out in a van and pick up somebody who is wounded. It might be one of their people, or it might be one of their enemies. They have had many incidents where, you know, they have gone and they picked up one of these militia fighters, the Wazalendo, who fight the M23, and they've had to argue on behalf of the wounded person so that the fighters on the road wouldn't execute them.
Mm.
And then they bring them to the hospital where they have a protocol. The Wazalender in one ward, that is to say the anti-M23 fighters. And if there's M23 or government soldiers wounded, they're in another ward.
So who is calling whom here? Is it the fighters calling the hospital saying, hey,
yes,
we need you to do a pickup
exactly
here? And then the hospital tells M23, give us free passage to pick up this wounded combatant?
Yeah, they don't say who it is. They've worked this out. So this is the result of, I think, quite arduous diplomacy at a grassroots level, so that the M23, which could, of course, just execute every Wazalender that they bring in, decided that they wouldn't do that because their own fighters are also attended to, treated by these doctors. So it was on the basis of that simple logic, look, you must let us do this because we're also helping your people.
That is a fascinating example of, as you say, grassroots diplomacy. At a higher level of diplomacy, Western countries have applied some limited sanctions on the warring parties, but they have been criticized for not exerting more diplomatic pressure. How do you explain this reluctance to intervene?
The war in the Congo, or the DRC, as people call it, the Democratic Republic of Congo, has become white noise to the outside world. This eternal conflict in the jungle, you know, fades into the background. We now have a president in the United States, as you know, who wants the Nobel Peace Prize. And he did proclaim that this was a war he had resolved because he'd managed to get emissaries from Rwanda and DRC, the Congo, together and to sign a kind of initial a promissory agreement towards peace. This is a kind of shape-shifting, rather awkward, and who knows what will happen kind of agreement that is moving forward. And on December 4th, supposedly, President Kagame and the president of the Congo will meet with President Trump and sign a document promising to carry out peace. And it has an economic component, which most of the negotiators that I talked to on all sides believe that gives the region the best chance at peace ever. The various parties will be given concessions or incentives to reduce the friction, to work together, because there will be an economic incentive.
We started this conversation with Trump's claim that he had ended the war. Did your time on the ground there give you any sense that it actually could end anytime soon?
Possibly. You're talking about disarming literally tens of thousands of men from at least 100 different ethnic groups and other groups that now feel power through the gun. And to disarm them in the face of an ineffective UN, what force is going to do that? The only people I talked to who were optimistic about it were the negotiators themselves. For this really to work, you know, you will have to have an extraordinary amount of applied energy and resources to make sure that this goes through. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it'll be a very, you know, it's going to be an uphill battle.
John Lee Anderson is the author of Can Trump's Peace Initiative Stop the Congo's 30-Year War? That's in The New Yorker. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Walkouts, resignations, backstage drama. This year's Miss Universe has been a wild ride, with the global pageant caught up in one controversy after another. It's not letting up, either. The crown was awarded about a week and a half ago. Then things took another turn, a far more serious and surprising one, as we hear from the world's Tibis Isaiah in Mexico City.
Here we go. Miss Universe is Mexico!
On November 21st, Fatima Bosch was crowned Miss Universe in Thailand. She wore a sparkly red and gold dress meant to honor what she called the gold of Mexico, corn. But even before she got to the final competition, she was already in the middle of tensions. A local organizer criticized Bosch for not posting enough content about Thailand on social media. And as cameras were rolling, he called her a dumb head.
Mexico, where are you? You are dumb head.
When she pushed back, other contestants walked out in solidarity.
And no one can shut our voice. And no one will do that to me. Thank you.
The organizer later apologized, but the tensions didn't end there. Just a day before the final vote, Three judges resigned.
J'ai décidé de démissionner de ma participation dans le jury de Miss Univers.
One of them, Lebanese musician Omar Hartfouch, accused the contest co-owner, Mexican businessman Raul Rocha, of trying to rig the outcome.
Raul Rocha asked me to vote for Miss Mexico a week before the show.
Hartfouch even claimed he saw a trophy with Mexico on it before the contest. And Fatima Bosch won. That could have been the end of the drama, but within days, the attention shifted squarely to Rocha, the Mexican businessman who co-owns Miss Universe. Mexican media revealed that one of his companies has a multi-million dollar contract with Pemex, Mexico's national oil company, where Bosch's father is a longtime executive. And then came something far more serious. Mexican prosecutors issued an arrest warrant for Rocha, accusing him of helping run a trafficking network moving fuel, drugs, and weapons across the Guatemala border, and of doing so with the complicity of officials inside Mexico's own federal prosecutor's office. Rocha denied the allegations.
Porque es falso. Es falso.
The scandal reached Mexico's president Palace.
Son procesos de investigación. Entonces tenemos que ser muy responsables en el proceso de investigación.
President Claudia Sheinbaum, who had initially celebrated Bosch's win, asked for caution and transparency. Carlos Elizondo Mayer Sierra, a political scientist at Monterrey Technology, says all of this leaves a mark.
Mancha el triunfo, mancha la corona.
It stains the victory, it stains the crown and the contest, he says.
Pero insisto, la mancha más grave es para el país.
But the most serious stain, he says, is for Mexico itself, because it shows how deep corruption goes between parts of the business sector and the political class. Mexico's attorney general says the investigation is active and ongoing. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
Up next on today's show, what two photographers have learned about life on a warming planet by taking portraits of people who have had to move because of climate change. Stay tuned for that conversation just ahead. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Two photographers from Switzerland are capturing the faces of people directly impacted by climate change. Through a series of portraits, Matthias Braschler and Monica Fischer are trying to tell human stories about being forced to leave home because of storms, drought, fire, floods, and rising seas. Their project is called Displaced. Matthias Braschler and Monica Fischer joined us earlier today from Zurich to talk about their work.
The first project we did in 2009 was called The Human Face of Climate Change. And there we traveled for about a year to different countries, different regions, just to set up and meet people that are directly affected by climate change. And the motivation to do this first project was like a previous project when we traveled and worked in China for about 9 months, shooting portraits of Chinese all over the country before the Olympic Games in 2008. And there we just saw what happens if a country develops really, really fast, the destruction it can do to nature, to the environment. And so we got really interested in looking at that, what it does to people. And so we decided to do something that focuses on climate change. And Displaced, that's a work we did the last 2 years, which is one step further, where we looked at people that already got displaced, that had to leave their home because of climate change.
So, Monica, in the past 2 years, as you've produced these portraits of people in this project Displaced, whose stories really stood out to you as you kind of go back through those frames?
Well, we met so many people. We visited 12 countries and met everywhere people who had to leave their home or lost their house, home because of climate change. Very impressive was in Kenya, Turkana, the IOM brought us there.
That's the International Migration Organization.
Exactly, International Organization of Migration. We had a collaboration with them. They helped us tremendously also to get to know people on the ground and brought us to places. And in Kenya, for example, the Turkana people in the north of the country, there it's so far because of the ongoing droughts. They have lost so many animals. The animals are dying. They lose their tradition. So what they are starting to do now is become farmers to settle. And with that comes a lot of loss of tradition as well. I mean, hundreds, thousands of years of tradition with climate change that happened the last decades.
One thing that I also find interesting is, I mean, of course, we went to these developing countries, poor people, they got really badly hit by climate change. But then again, here in Switzerland, not too far away from where we live, 1.5 hours drive, we met a veterinarian who lost everything because there was like this incredible heavy precipitation event. It was like raining like never before. And in this mountain village of Brienz, like a little creek swole to a crazy river who destroyed part of the village, and his house got really seriously damaged. And I think that's one of the interesting things to see, like LA, for example, as well. These effects, they're not just happening in remote places like Bangladesh or Kenya or Senegal. We're in a stage now where highly developed countries like Switzerland, Germany, or the US are also heavily affected.
So these are photos of people forced to leave their homes due to climate-related events. You were intentional about the subjects of your photos posed studio-style against a pitch-black background. And interspersed in this series of portraits are snapshots of the landscapes around their deserted homes. What was the intention behind these choices?
Well, we brought this pop-up studio with us to all the destinations, wherever we met the people. And for us, it was important to show it's also about losing their roots. And we wanted to show everybody the same way. It's a very universal problem all around the globe. And we wanted to give the same appearance, the same background to everybody. Mm. What's also important that we wanted to show the people in a strong way, in a dignified way. It's not just the victims. Migration to move on is also a way of adapting to climate change. It always has been a means of adapting to changing environments. But because climate change is accelerating so fast at the moment, it's also an overwhelmingly big problem. But we wanted to show that people in all their dignity and that they are strong and proud people that we met.
So these people have to adapt, but they also are losing what they know is home. Does home ever get reproduced once they've adapted?
No, I don't think so. It's a long process. It's really a long process. It just takes a lot of time. And certain things you lose forever. And I think particularly also for people that go through these major disasters like hurricanes, like a wildfire or floods, they also lose some kind of security, like something that you take for granted. Mm. There's like some this basic security that my house is going to be okay, where I live it's okay, my life is okay. And if this is taken away from you by force, by nature, it takes something away from you, which I think is very hard to get back.
So Displaced was produced in collaboration with the United Nations Immigration and Food Security Agencies. Monica, what do you hope people take away from viewing these portraits, from this project of yours?
Well, our goal was to give the people who lost their home a voice and a face. So we let them tell the story. And we hope that people can look into their eyes and listen to their stories. We did also a lot of video about it, so we can also hear how they tell the story. But I think very important is we know climate change is happening. We know it's a huge problem. And still there's so much going on, so much happening that it got into the background in the daily life for many people at the moment. And for us, it's important to be a reminder that it is a huge issue. And it's also, it's not going away. Climate change will be a huge issue in the future. We know a lot of solutions. And what we need, even us doing this project, is the reminder what we do it for.
Swiss photographers Monica Fischer and Matthias Braschler spoke with me from Zurich. Their new project is called Displaced.
At a star-studded awards ceremony last night in New York, a dissident Iranian filmmaker won big.
And the 2025 Gotham Award for Best Director goes to Jafar Panahi.
That is a well-known name both to film buffs and authorities in Iran.
On the same day, Jafar Panahi won that Gotham Award. He was also sentenced in absentia to 1 year in Iranian prison on charges of spreading anti-government propaganda.
Panahi was just in our Boston studio telling us about his new film. It's a dark comedy about a former prisoner who thinks he's found his torturer at an auto shop.
Perhaps the torturer, too, must have thought about what happens if he gets recognized one day.
That conversation is later this week on The World. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.